Mark Twain says, he goes, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. And with what's happening today, we're seeing just a serious crisis in confidence in the markets. There's a lot of parallels between that today and what I was seeing in 2009, 2010, 11.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk-takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Pleasure of speaking with Marcin Derost. Marcin is a managing partner of M1 Real Capital, where he and his team focus on acquiring value-add multifamily properties throughout the Southeast. And over the past 18 years, he has established himself as the go-to in world of capital raising and deal structuring. And he's sourced well into nine figures of capital, private capital that is, to acquire over 1,600 units across the US and fund several different businesses. When he's not on the lookout for new opportunities, he is teaching up-and-coming real estate investors about how to raise capital, scale their business, and launch their fund. I'm really excited and pumped to have him on the show today to share his incredible knowledge, but enough out of me. Let's get him out here. Marcin, welcome to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
Appreciate you having me. Looking forward to it.
Let's rewind the clock and tell me how you made your first ever dollar as a kid.
First dollar I made was picking up golf balls. And I picked up golf balls at a driving range. So you probably know the story. I used to have them. You'd whack a ball from a driving range, and then the golf ball picker would pick up most of them. But what would end up happening is a bunch of them would end up in the sand or whatever it was. So us kids, you know, we're 10, 11, 12 years old, go out there in the evenings with milk crates, like those big milk crates, and you got paid $2 a crate. So you'd be out there running around, and eventually you'd figure out like systems. You'd have like hockey sticks to try to like, you know, rakes and all this stuff. And yeah, it was interesting. You make 20, 30 bucks a night. I mean, you were 10 years old, 12 years old, you're rich, right?
Walk us through the journey of, you know, your story. And was there a pre-real estate journey, corporate world, or was it just straight into it from the get-go?
Early days, I went to school. I thought I was going to become a lawyer. That was kind of what my family was directing me towards, especially my mom, because, you know, Polish, Eastern European, you want to say that your son's a lawyer, an accountant, or a doctor, or something like that, right? So I started down the path with school, but while I was doing that, I was buying properties on the side. So I read Rich Dad Poor Dad, bought a few of these courses, did some stuff, flipped a house or two, and then it was time to graduate, and I did an internship downtown, and I very quickly figured out I did not want to be in that world. So I immediately ran for the exit. Got into private equity, was lucky enough to get recruited into that space in my little early 20s. I was 21, 22 years old. And, you know, one thing led to another, got an opportunity to work under some really cool people, learned a lot of stuff, saw how big deals were made. You know, you go from buying, you know, your own little single family house or rental property to, okay, kid, we're buying this 200 unit building, and then we're buying another one next month, and then we're buying another one, right? So your mentality at that early age, I mean, how do you go back, right? So for me, that was just, you know, I was hooked, hook, line, sinker. I worked there for a few years, raised a bunch of money, learned how to, you know, put the deals together, the structure, the legal, all that stuff. And then, you know, the world kind of broke. 2010, 2011, I started building my own funds. And, you know, fast forward a few decades later, a little bit of gray hair, and here we are.
Who was the private equity firm that you worked for back in the day?
It was a family office. It was FT Capital. It was a family office.
And that would have been early days. You said 08, 09. So was that before the crash or just as the crash was happening?
So it was right. It was so funny that you ask that. So I literally get recruited. I get hired. I move out west. I turn my whole life upside down. And I'm sitting in the office and I'm looking at the screen and Lehman Brothers just laid everyone off and they're walking everybody out with the banker boxes. Like that was ingrained in my brain. I'm sitting there. And I remember my mom calling me. She's like, so how's it going? I'm like, it's great.
Your ventures into today and what you're building, maybe give the snapshot of the portfolio and what you do.
When COVID hit, we were lucky because we were mostly cash at that point. I mean, we did buy some stuff into COVID and, you know, we had a couple hundred doors that we were liquidating during that process. But what had happened was, like yourself, you're at home. And, you know, they were telling us to, you know, flatten the curve or whatever story we were all being told to stay home and eat bonbons for a few months, right? So I'm at home kind of crawling up the walls. And at the same time, I've got people calling me and asking me about deal structuring. Hey, I'm working on this, I'm working on that. And calls that I normally didn't have the time for, I now had the time for. So I literally started walking people through deals, through transactions. And that's literally during COVID when I started to, you know, make the most of what I had in my head. And I started writing out all the systems and the processes, which ended up becoming, you know, the mentorship side that we do on the capital raising business, because it was like you never had the time to just sit there and sit with your thoughts for a little bit. But COVID allowed me to do that. So that's been fantastic. Since then, we've bought a few more buildings. We just bought 144 units in Houston, Texas. So I really like the Texas story, probably for the same reason you do. And I think with what's happening today, where we're seeing just a serious crisis in confidence in the markets, there's a lot of parallels between that today and what I was seeing, you know, maybe inadvertently back then in 2009, 2010, 2011.
What did you see? What are the sort of, I don't know, 3 to 5 things that you can say, aha, looking back, that happened exactly the same as what is happening now?
So the first thing was, people were throwing money out like it was going to expire. Like literally, if you're not going to spend it, it's going to expire. Like that was the mentality people had back then. You know, people were refining their houses back then, like ATMs. They were doing all the things that they were doing back then. And we all saw this. I had friends that bought boats for $50,000 who sold them, flipped them 3 months later for $90,000. I had friends buying trucks and Rolexes. Instead of $25,000 from the dealer, people are paying $45,000 on the street. The cryptocurrency industry, whether you think that's real or speculation, the point is the prices went nuts. And there was just so much money being thrown at things. And I think it was because, one, all the stimulus that was out there, but two, was the interest rates. So it was literally the same thing back then. It was different because it was driven by the residential consumer in the asset prices. Today, it was mostly driven on the commercial side. It looks like a different problem today, but it all comes back to the same thing. There's a massive systemic crisis in confidence. And, you know, raising money today, I mean, I don't know if you guys are noticing it, but it's a different game to raise money today than it was even 24 months ago.
Let's dive a little bit deeper into that on the confidence side, but what you said on the pensions. My perspective, again, I wasn't around in 2008, but I was started in 2013, 14. If you look back at also what happened at that time and why there was a lot of money in commercial real estate, the Jobs Act in 2012, like that had a huge impact on how people can access deals and advertise deals. And if you remember, there was also a lot of crowdfunding, right? It was cruising the internet, real estate still very mano a mano. You're not just going to chuck $100,000 in, you know, a deal you see online at 10 o'clock at night. But that was the intention, right? That was the right thought. And but then also coupled with the crash of 08, but then the sort of demystification of commercial real estate as an alternative asset and seeing these bigger players like the pension funds and all that sort of stuff start to put money. And they may have historically done it, but it seems like there's a lot more people in the lane today or over the last decade, which help create a frenzy coupled with lower interest rates. And then obviously you've got, you know, the pandemic that happened towards the tail end. But in my opinion, it sort of started with that 2012 timeframe of how you could raise money, the access to deals. And I just, again, would love your opinion on what, if you thought that has had any effect on where we sit today in a very, very crowded lane, particularly in the multifamily space.
The Jobs Act definitely did democratize investing, and that's kind of a gift and a curse all at the same time. And what I mean by that is because it became so much easier for people to invest in what were historically alternative assets, two things ended up happening. A lot of good happened in the marketplace where people did do good deals and create billions of dollars of net worth and value for other people. But at the same time, what ended up happening is there's always two sides to a coin. There's people that are going to take it for the right reasons. There's going to be other people that are going to look at that and go, oh, there's some fees here for us, right? So unfortunately, whenever you open up the market on a capital raising standpoint, you end up getting the good and you end up getting some unintended, you know, consequences. So the Jobs Act, I remember reading it and looking into it, and I thought to myself, okay, this is going to go either really well or it's going to go not so well. And what's the saying is, You can be the good, you can start out as the hero, but if you live long enough, you become the enemy, right? You live long enough to become the villain, right? So I think we're starting to see some of that stuff in this market space where some people are becoming vilified. And look, some maybe did things maliciously, but a lot of people, I just think they got caught up in enthusiasm, which brings me to my second point, which is when you have retail capital being able to get into something kind of totally open borders, so to speak, then what ends up happening is you drive up things beyond what the smart money would have naturally driven those things up to. So, you know, what percentage of that caused the corrections that are happening in commercial here? I don't know what those numbers are, but the thing that's always been interesting to me is that the money that's raised through these alternative channels is a minnow compared to the killer whales that actually run the real money, like KKR, Blackstone, Apollo, you know, Fortress Investment Group out of New York. Like, these are multi-billion dollar conglomerates. And when they move into a sector like build to rent, or when they move into an industry or a market, or, you know, in Texas, you see where they go into certain areas, Austin or otherwise, when they go in, they don't just go in with 50 million, they go in with 500 million, they go in with a billion, they go in with a couple billion. So that moves the whole market, I think, a lot more than just few guys like you and me raising, you know, $50 million or $100 million or $200 million and buying a few buildings. But did it move the needle? Yeah, it did. And, you know, the other thing too is it probably took some risk off the institutional guys, because I know guys that have bought from those guys and they've taken the risk off that.
I think as you tie it back into today's run up in interest rates, there's a lot of both smart money, as you said, and, you know, unsophisticated money that made mistakes, right? And you can't just say it's all one side or the other. A lot of people made bets on the lending side. We had then too much stimulus in the economy, and you got to now, you know, deal with inflation, and thus, you know, right or wrong, Mr. J Money Powell, as you know, increased interest rates, you know, 500% in a very short period of time, asset values will go down, and everyone who thought they were the smartest person in the room across the board are now looking at potential big losses because asset values are not what they were, you know, 2 years ago.
In hindsight, it should have been obvious that the interest rates were going to go up, but I think people at this point were just hoping that the party wouldn't stop.
There's so many lessons to learn. I remember walking around the halls of a very big. Do you think that the flight to real assets today will create a floor for pricing here in the US? As you start to see, you know, and are you seeing deals starting to come back to market? You mentioned you've got 144 units in Houston.
I'll give you an example. Okay, practically speaking, that building I bought it for approximately half of a replacement cost. Now, I would have never historically bragged about that as a metric, but today it's valuable. The reason for it is because cost to build has gone up so much ever since COVID that everything that's standing in good shape is now naturally more valuable because replacing it is going to become that much more expensive. So literally, I bought it, renovated. I'm still, I think, 60% of cost to build. So it's like, okay, why is that valuable? Well, as long as you're in a market where there's employment and demand and all that stuff, there's always going to be people that are going to want to live there. So the guy that's going to build next to me or across the street or whatever is immediately going to have to contend with a 30 to 40% headwind just on the build. And that's a big deal today. And my point is this: 10 years ago, that wouldn't have been the major thing that I would have talked about. But today, that is such a big thing because of the price of lumber and the price of labor, the cost of all these things, right? These are big factors. Now, and then to answer your question or to comment on your thing directly here, I think it's super possible that we're going to see a market where everything is, you know, 3% or 30% more than what it is, or 300% more than what it is now in paper, but we're all making more money. So everybody's a millionaire on paper, but a cup of coffee is $37 as an example. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if this is going to be 5 years or 3 years or 10, but I think we're going in that direction. And, you know, again, taking the example of other countries, I mean, whether it was Poland or Russia or other parts of the world were just printing money and they tried to raise interest rate. All that happens is they just print more money faster to keep up with it. And you know, the US is doing the same thing. The national debt keeps going up, not down.
What other things are you predicting coming into the next sort of 3 to 5 years? And are you, and do you think now is a good time to be buying?
First of all, it's always a good time to buy for the right price, right? That's the thing that we can't agree on today yet with buyers and sellers is what the price is worth. And I think, you know, given a long enough time frame, the buyers are always going to win because they can afford to wait and the sellers can't. So what do I mean by that? In the market today, and you've probably seen the stats as well as I have, a lot of the loans that are coming due right now, there's a lot of bankers making phone calls where they have clients that they know are they're done. Like they're one step away from getting the keys back on thousands of doors, literally thousands of doors across the US, not just Florida, not just Texas, not just LA, like just everywhere, like across the entire, you know, good chunk of the US. So what does that mean? Well, it means that ultimately the banks are going to be the ones with the problem. And the thing about the banks is a lot of the banks, they all have rules and regulations around when they have to write off their loans. So they can only pretend and extend for so long until somebody from the compliance department is going to show up and say, hey, what's going on with this loan? Oh, when was the last time they paid? Oh, 6 months ago. Oh, 12 months ago. Okay, cool. You have 30 days. Get it off the books. And I don't know if I've seen a lot of that yet, but when that starts happening, that's when you're going to really start seeing the sellers, because at that point, the banks are just going to basically push the sellers aside and be like, hey, this is being sold, your equity's out. And we're literally starting to get those calls where, you know, you're getting calls from banks where they're like, hey, let me know what you think about this. Theoretically, if you took it over, you know, what would you pay for it? And it, the fact that the banks are now chumming the waters, so to speak, to figure out who's there, tells you that they're a lot of them getting ready to step in and basically start to reposition assets. They're going to try to hold the line for as long as they can. But what's going to end up happening is they're going to realize, I think, like everybody else, I think they're hoping that the Fed's going to bail them out. And, you know, they're going to come around and say, hey, just kidding, rates are back at 1% or rates are at 2% or whatever it is. But we're not seeing that. And I don't think we're going to see it. I mean, people think rates are high now. They're not high. They're just where they used to be. Right. Like buying a 7 cap or 8 cap was normal. Buying a 9 cap was normal. I mean, I remember when, you know, 10 cap was like you were looking for 8, 9, 10 caps because rates were 6, 7. Like this is all normal. And the problem is the sellers are not cluing in. And, you know, the buyers are just sitting there, and they're even the people that want to buy, it's not penciling. So what are they doing?
The lenders also got to come to the table, right? Back to my statement earlier, like it's not just the buyers who made the bad decisions. It's also the lending. The lenders lent at that time and now have things on the books that are worth less than what the loan is. And I am seeing a couple of REOs starting to hit the market right now in certain markets that I think is a very good time to be buying. But to your point of replacement costs, like we're picking up 176 units in San Antonio, Texas, and I'm buying it at $105 a square foot. You know, like it's, you can't build that, you know, on 17 acres where, you know, the average unit per acre is less than 6. Like it's, you know, like you just, to replace that exact product, you'd be spending $250 a square foot right today on a 2-to-3-story garden style apartment. It is what everyone's talking about. So if you're an active investor out there listening to that, I really understand what you're picking up the, what well, it is a replacement cost of going in assets today. You know, there is an argument around, well, yes, it's an 80s vintage or 70s vintage versus a 2023 vintage, but, you know, to rip it down and start again, there is some validity to, you know, shoring up your bets in terms of a safer bet in an investment in a deal that is in a good, well-located area that people are still going to want to need a roof over their head for the foreseeable future.
There's also a big gap in the market for construction. So I was talking to Ken Macro about this, and he was walking me through the graph where the construction had kind of fallen off a cliff during the early 2010s and didn't really pick up till the mid-2010s. And that 4 or 5 year period, that was a gap in the marketplace. We never recovered that. That was never built. So it's not like it was tagged on later and built. So as more product continues to age and get torn down or whatever it is, we never replaced that product. And there's about a 5 million housing unit gap that was never replaced. So on top of today, prices being where they're at, rents being where they're at, affordability being squeezed, we actually don't currently have a way to replace that inventory. And that is the problem. So, you know, I'm seeing a lot of guys that are right now literally picking up newer product, and they're doing it with the intention, knowing that they're not going to make as much money today on that product, but they're banking on the, because there's a lot of housing that hit the market earlier this year and late last year. There was kind of a post-COVID kind of build out that just kind of finished. And they're betting on the fact, really smart guys, they're betting on the fact that that in a year to 2 years, when it finally hits the market and vacancy rates just get destroyed because there's nowhere to live, that all of a sudden, all that stuff they picked up at par today is going to become incredibly valuable. So that's an interesting outlook too.
Mate, at the end of every show, we like to dive into the top five investing tips. You ready to get into it?
Let's do it.
Mate, question number one, what is a daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
I think the sincere answer is to just sit in the morning, kind of just sit quietly with myself for 5 or 10 minutes before I flip the monitor on, flip the screen on, and just kind of reflect on what that big thing is today. Because you know how it is. You can have 20 things to do you want to do in a day, but you know, what is that one or two things that you have to get done?
Question number two is, who's been the most influential person in your career to date?
So the person that comes front of mind right now, in my mind, just because I was reading his book recently, is Ryan Holiday. I don't personally know him, but he's an author. He wrote a book called The Obstacle is the Way. What's in the way becomes the way. So that's been very influential. And, you know, by extension, Marcus Aurelius, he's the guy who's kind of one of the godfathers of stoicism, so to speak.
Question number three is, what's the most influential tool in your business? Now, when I say tool, it could be a physical tool like a journal or a phone, or it's a piece of software that you just can't run the business without. What is it?
Most influential tool for me, I think, is that's my ability to be quiet. And what I mean by that is silence is a tool for me, because I naturally prefer to lead conversations and engage and things like that. But I find, especially internally, whether it's personally or professionally, if I can be silent and just ask really good questions, I typically get a lot more out of the conversation.
Question number four is, in one sentence, what's been the biggest failure in your career? And what did you learn from that failure?
Biggest failure for me, the one that's most meaningful to me, is, I guess it's a consistent theme, is when you plan too far ahead in life, thinking that you're somehow in charge of what's going to happen along the way. So, and I say that tongue in cheek, because I could apply that to making plans for a weekend, hour by hour, or to a business. And in both cases, it kicks you in the ass, because if you know, what's the joke? Man plans and God laughs, right? So man makes plans and God laughs, right? Like there's nothing wrong with having like plans, but the way I planned it is as if I knew what the like outcome would be on a daily basis. And for me, every time I do that, I end up, you know, you just end up setting up yourself for disappointment.
Last question, where can people reach you to continue the conversation that will be in your sphere? Where do they go?
Best place is my website, marcindros.com. Check it out there. There's resources. There's all kinds of things people can learn about myself, my story, books, that kind of stuff.
Well, Marcin, I want to thank you so much for coming on today's show. Really insightful conversation around, I could talk to you for hours, really, because of your experience in comparing the parallels between 2008 and today, and looking back at, you know, even in myself in my own investing career, like thinking about like what's going on right now in those sort of frothy times, and being diligent. But also then what's the reckoning that's coming right now, and how do you continue to invest money in today's market, has been really, really valuable for, I think, the listeners and for myself, taking that away from today's show to understand, you know, you're still going to be prudent without what you do. There's still going to be times people are still going to need a roof over their head. There will be a lull. Even though, you know, you might think that vacancies are through the roof and rent rates are low, but there will be a lull with the fact that the constructions are coming to a slow, and the cost of labor is also continuing to increase. But also then there's some really cool things you just said at the end there. The silence is a tool. I think I've never had anyone tell me that silence is a tool. It's a very powerful thing to sit with your own thoughts before you speak, and is a hard muscle to exercise in times when you want to jump into the conversation. So
I think a good parting comment for everybody, and a mentor shared this with me, I'll share it with you, is it's not about return on capital until you know how you're going to see return of capital. And that's probably a really, really important thought to keep front row center today, because the smartest people I know, the wealthiest people I know, don't care about how much they can make until they know how much they could potentially lose. And once they fully understand the risk, then the return potential is in the context of that.
Well, mate, thank you so much for jumping on today's show. Enjoy the rest of your week and weekend, and we'll catch up very, very soon.
That was cool. Appreciate you.
Well, there you have another cracking episode jam-packed with some incredible advice from Marcin. Remember to go check him out at his personal website. You can Google his name anyway, and he'll come up online. If you do like this show, the easiest way to give back is to give it a 5-star review on iTunes. You can get all the show notes from today's show on my website at reedgoossens.com. We're going to do this all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go keep life.